Welcome to the Father's Day. I am Jesse Lee Peterson. And don't forget to hit the like button and the notification bell, all right? Very interesting show today. I'm learning today, so I have really good questions because I want to know. A lot of this is new to me. I have with me Abigail Sagi. She is a professor of sociology and gender studies at UCLA. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
You have a brand new book, and we'll get to that. But I first wanted to ask you about the book, What's Wrong with Fat?
Yes, that was my second book.
What's Wrong with Fat is the second one. So this is the third one.
That's the third book,
That's amazing. You're a busy lady.
I try to keep myself out of trouble.
That's amazing. But first, explain to us what exactly is sociology. What do you do? And gender studies. Gender studies. What are those two things?
Oh, big questions. Good questions. Yeah. So sociology is the study of collective behavior. Whenever you have more than one person in a room, you've got sociology happening. Sociologists study all kinds of things. We study politics. We study families. Study social movements. And sociologists believe that they don't take an individual person as kind of the starting point or the unit of analysis. They take many people together, collections of people. We sociologists actually believe that individuals emerge from or created or a product of social groups. You know, human beings never live alone. They can't survive. A human child could not learn to walk, to read, to talk alone. We have to have communities and families and social organizations to function and to develop. And those are all the things that sociologists study.
So you believe, sociologists, folks believe that if a child is born, when a child is born, if they didn't have someone there to teach them how to speak and how to grow and how to this, they would not learn naturally?
Yeah, well, there have been what people call natural experiments. These are things that you would never do intentionally, would never get approved by an institutional review board. But there have been cases in which children have been found who have been raised in almost isolation, children who were raised in an attic and only were given food and water, or children who were in the wild and who were raised by animals and wolves, for instance. And those children do not develop normally. They don't walk, they don't talk, they don't develop cognitively normally. Now, they can then catch up if, you know, once they are integrated into a human context and family and others. But yeah, we human beings need other humans to even become human, right? To develop all of our characteristically human traits.
So it sounds like that would be the purpose of the parents, the father and the mother, to be like living examples so that as the kids are developing, they learn from those examples.
I mean, there's all kinds of family organizations that have existed over time and exist in work. What's important is that there be a community, that there be other human beings to look after and take care of children.
And what is gender studies?
So gender studies is sometimes departments are called women's studies, sometimes they're called gender studies. They have a history that goes back to what's often called the second wave women's movement in the 1970s. They didn't exist before that. But they are departments that specialize in studying relations of gender. And so what is gender? Well, typically the way I teach it in my sociology of gender class is that there is biological sex, and these are the differences, physical differences
between male and female.
Okay. Yes. And then gender are the social meaning that we give to those physical differences. And so, I mean, much like race, right? There are some phenotypical differences between people, but the concept of race is a really socially constructed one that depends, in this country is largely constructed through the history of slavery, et cetera. It's a social arrangement, and similarly with gender. So the fact that, you know, pilots are more often men than women. That's not due to some biological difference. That's due to social differences that we ascribe to, at the end of the day, pretty small biological differences.
Meaning that a man who is a pilot is more likely to get you there safely than a woman because he won't freak out if something should go wrong?
Well, so I love that you raised that. So that idea that like women are non-rational, right, or hysterical, that is a stereotype that then can explain what, you know, it's part of the ways in which women get subordinated in society. In the same way that other groups, you know, stereotypes or preconceived notions that are completely false of African Americans being less intelligent than whites, completely unfounded.
Is that unfounded? People, I thought that was true.
Based on what my research knows, it's absolutely not true. But it's a very useful way to justify subordinating a group. And similarly, for women, you put your finger right on it. You know, women being more emotional, yeah, is one of the ways that they have been said, well, this person couldn't possibly be in a position of power or control because, you know, how could they have access to, like, nuclear weapons, right, when they're on their period? They're just
right,
going to repress it. And, of course, men have hormones, too. Women and men have some of the same hormones. Men have lots of fluctuations as well in terms of their hormones. They
tend to vary by day. Who's more likely to freak out in a situation, a man or a woman?
I don't know that we know that. And in general, what we find for most differences, gender differences between men and women, is that there is way more variation within a group than between the groups. So you can sometimes find average differences between men and women, but there's just so much difference within the group and so much overlap. You
right,
know, if you were to track like a normal distribution, so much overlap between them that you wouldn't be able to predict, for instance, who's more likely to freak out just by knowing this is a woman or a man.
I noticed that when I, lately, I get on a plane and sometimes I see females who are pilots, but there are men with them too,
making sure they don't freak out.
Right. I remember once I got on a small plane going from somewhere to somewhere, and there were two female pilots, right? Mm-hmm. I felt very concerned, very concerned. Mm-hmm. Whereas had it been two men, I would have felt no concern about it because I know that women tend to overreact to things because of their emotions.
Do you study
why that is?
Well, what we would study is why you would feel that way, and that, you know, and how those fears that are actually not, you know, not any more grounded than some of the other stereotypes we have of other people, how those get reproduced,
oh,
and
I
how
see.
They are then used to justify, you know, pushing women into jobs that are less well paid and have less autonomy and less authority, justifying that men move. And it's not just men and women as well. I mean, these things are always working intersectionally. So it's the white men who are more likely to be the pilots and the surgeons and the CEOs, and women of all races and men of color who tend to be moved into, you know, tend to be in the, have a harder time in those more powerful positions. And so we, you know, in sociology of gender today, and it hasn't always been the case, black feminists have accused, very rightly so, a lot of feminist authors and gender studies authors for not sufficiently taking into account race. And so I think the best work happening now in gender studies is intersectional, and it's looking not just at how men and women are treated differently, but that knowing that you're never being treated or viewed as just a woman or just as man.
Amazing.
You're always being treated as, you know, a white man, a black man, a white woman, black woman, and all of the other possibilities, age and nationality, etc.
You mentioned the white man and the pilot, for example.
Mm-hmm.
In America, it would be natural to see more white people, white men flying airplanes because America was created by white people, founded by white people, by white men.
Built by black people.
And then they hired the black people that the Arabs brought in to help build the country. But if you went to Africa where they're majority blacks, then you would see more black pilots and less white men driving or flying a plane, am I right? Because of the population.
Well, it's the population, and it's also systems of inequality that are not just historical, but get reproduced every day and are very contemporary.
But you do agree that the population has something to do with it, too. If there are more white people or black people in Africa, naturally you're going to see more of that race.
So there are not many Jewish people, 1% of the population. I think Jews are only about 1% of the U.S. population, too. And yet you see them nonetheless in positions of authority, et cetera, they've moved into. So I don't think it's simply, and of course there's lots of anti-Semitism and discrimination, but, you know, they've nonetheless moved into those positions. So I don't think it's just about percentages. I think there have been, you know, systems of discrimination that continue today that are very powerful, that really disadvantage. This is now, we're moving a little bit out of my area of study because I am not a race scholar.
But I just want, because I'm trying to understand it, but you do consider the population too, right? That if there are more,
if you go
to Israel, of course you're going to have more Jewish pilots because there are more Jews.
There's also a lot of
Israel, right?
There's also a lot of discrimination and oppression of Palestinians in Israel, so that's part of it too. But no, I mean, just go back to women. Women are over half of the population, and yet we're not half of the pilots.
We're not half
of the doctors. We're not half of the surgeons. We're more than half of the nurses. We're more than half of a lot of other professions, social work. Women are very underrepresented also in the trades, you know, construction.
But that's because they got a late start.
You know, it's been a while, so I think, anyway, these are the kinds of things we would explore in a class in sociology of gender. These are exactly the kinds of things. Why is it that we see these patterns in which different races, ethnicities are not evenly or randomly distributed in terms of profession?
But life doesn't work like that. Nothing is evenly distributed.
And so sociologists, they try to figure out the patterns.
Oh, I see.
And one of the things they try to, part of what they try to figure out, particularly when you're moving into something like sociologists of gender, sociologists of race, is they're trying to understand what are the social factors, because again, that's what we specialize in, right? Sociologists don't study genetics, we don't study evolution, we study social processes.
Okay.
So what are the social processes that maintain and reproduce inequalities? And that's, you know, these are one of the things that we do study, and these are, you know, kind of the big context in which I've been doing my research.
Before I get to your new book, I want to ask you about fatness.
Sure.
Right? And what is your opinion on fatness? What do you think about
that?
Because I noticed that people are trying to push fatness like it's a nice thing, right?
Uh-huh.
You got all these fat women running around half naked and showing their fat butts. And
So where's that? I haven't seen that spot.
There's one black rapper right now, woman.
Lizzo?
Yeah, she is gross, and she's old, and she's fat. And
that must not be
the rapper. Is it Lizzo? Yeah, Lizzo.
She's not old.
She was at a fat ball.
If Lizzo is old, then I'm ancient, and you, let's not even start.
I'm ancient. God made me, and then he made dirt for me to walk on. But that's how old I am. But
Lizzo is pretty gorgeous, in my opinion. But
what do you think about fatness?
I published this book in 2013, What's Wrong with Fat? And what I was trying to answer in this question was, how is it that we have come to believe in this world, and your statements are a great example of this, how have we become so certain that it's unhealthy, it's undesirable, it's ugly? Like, where is that coming from, and what are the social implications of that? And what are some other ways to understand bigger bodies? So, you know, the dominant way we talk about fatness, and we don't usually use the term, I do in that work.
Right.
Most people will talk about obesity. They'll talk about overweight. And even using those terms, right, you're already implying this is a medical problem, this is unhealthy. Call in the doctors, send out the public health warnings. But actually, when you go and start looking at the research, you find a few things. First of all, it became socially undesirable to be heavy before it was considered a medical problem. And so it's an interesting case in which people's social preferences and biases came before the medicine. It was in really the turn of the 20th century when, and why was it happening? Well, in many places around the world and also in previous places, times in the U.S., it was considered desirable and beautiful to be heavy. Why? Because there wasn't enough food to go around. And so if you had a little extra weight on you, that meant you weren't starving, you know, and you were healthier than those people who
were. Get less food at the table.
And it was a sign of wealth. No, I mean, the wealthy hoard the resources. And but then this starts to shift in the early 20th century. And as it does, and as being heavy is no longer a sign of wealth, it also becomes no longer socially desirable. And it's later, it's not until the mid-50s that doctors start saying this is a medical problem. And it's even later into the 90s that public health officials start talking about this as an epidemic, the raising rights of people of heavier weights.
So you don't believe that fatness can be a health problem?
So that's not my argument. I think that in some cases, higher weight is associated with increased risk.
But
it's association. And, you know, in science, we say always be careful. And association does not necessarily mean causation. Association and causation are not the same thing. So, for instance, type 2 diabetes, that's a case where the association is very strong. Higher weight, and it's linear. So, like, from even the lowest weights, as weight goes higher,
right,
your risk of type 2 diabetes, the associated risk, is higher. But we don't really know the causation. It might be that higher weight causes type 2 diabetes, but it might also be that insulin resistance, which is related to type 2 diabetes, causes weight gain, or that some third factor, like bad diet, lack of exercise, causes both.
So let me ask, I'm black and I'm slow, so I may ask in a weird way. Are you trying to prove that fatness doesn't cause diseases and death, or is not? Cause high blood pressure and all this stuff.
I'll leave to the epidemiologists and the medical doctors that out.
That it's attractive or something?
No. What I show is that there's different ways of understanding, or sociologists talk about framing. There's different ways to frame an issue or to present an issue.
Right.
And I show that the medical and public health crisis issue has become dominant in part because of the negative stereotypes and social implications of being heavier. In part because today in the U.S. and in other wealthy nations, those who are heavier also tend to be poorer, tend to be people of color, and the elites are the ones who tend to be thinner, and that's also a way that they can distinguish themselves from others. And
it's because they eat better, the ones that with the money, opposed to one that doesn't.
You know, there's lots of reasons that explain why the wealthier are thinner. Yes, part of it is that they have access to, you know, the fruits and vegetables, et cetera. They have access to gyms. They have more time. They're not working three jobs.
Right.
Being poor and working multiple jobs is very stressful. That stress causes cortisol levels to increase, which leads to weight gain. Being discriminated against also raises stress and cortisol level, which causes more weight gain. And in fact, one of the things I show in the book is all of this anti-fat bias that we heap on people because they're heavier, and we tell them you're ugly and you shouldn't be going out. Like, that actually has been shown to make people heavier, not thinner. And they're also less likely to get to the doctor. And when they do get to the doctor, they're less likely to get adequate medical care because the doctors share these biases and they look at heavier people. And I've heard this especially from women. They go to the doctor, they have a sore throat, they have a sore knee, and the doctor says, well, you know why you're experiencing this. It doesn't matter what it is. You know why. It's because of your weight. Go lose some weight and come back.
So should fat people hold on to the fat, or should they get rid of it?
Believe me, anyone who's fat, if you have a conversation with anyone who is fat, ask them about, maybe you don't want to ask them, I'll just tell you, they've tried. And typically they've been on more diets than been on.
Yeah.
And they do lose weight short term. But you know what happens for about 90% of people who lose weight on a diet?
They get it back.
They gain back and then some. Yeah. And so telling them to lose weight or telling them that they're not okay the way they are.
So what should you tell them, that they are okay, or
I think you just,
or you should be like, you know what? I don't mean any harm, but you should get rid of that fat.
Well, you know, I don't think that's going to be very helpful because they've already tried.
But can't you be nice about the way you say it?
I think you try. I mean, my philosophy in life is try to be nice to everybody. Yeah. Kindness. I think that's a really great thing.
Would you want to be fat, you personally?
Would I want to be fat? Would I want to take on discrimination and be mistreated in society? No.
So you're saying that being fat, people are discriminated against them, right?
There's a lot of discrimination.
And that puts on stress for the fat person, and they get fatter.
There's a lot of evidence that that is what happens.
So now
yes.
that white people, especially white men, are being discriminated against, should we expect to see a lot of fat white men?
Fat white men are being discriminated against, really?
Should we be able to
this
see a lot
a
of fat
flash?
White men? So what is fat phobia? What is that?
So, you know,
you write
and this,
about that,
this
right?
Yeah, this actually starts to link into my new book a little bit.
Yeah.
Come out, whoever you are.
Right.
Because this term fat phobia is borrowed from, it's inspired by another word. Does it can you guess what term fat phobia? There's another kind of phobia we talk about a lot.
White supremacists.
That, I mean, white supremacy is a real problem, but a word that has phobia in it.
White phobia.
Homophobia.
Oh, that's so, where fat phobia came from?
I believe so.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So one of the things that I found really surprising when I started doing research at the Fat Acceptance Movement in the year 2000.
Fat Acceptance?
I went to the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, was holding a conference in Cherry Hill, New Jersey in the summer of 2000. I happened at the time to have my stomach out to here because I was pregnant.
Right.
I was like 7 months pregnant. And I thought maybe that would help me blend in.
Right.
That was completely silly because people can tell the difference
right.
between fat and pregnant.
Yeah.
I was a little nervous going there, you know, as a thinner woman, would I be welcome? Would I be able to talk to people? People were incredibly welcoming and very happy to talk about their experiences. And I was very surprised when I started asking people, how did you get involved in the fat acceptance movement? People said to me, let me tell you about when I came out as fat. And I thought, what does it mean to come out as
right.
fat?
You're fat. I can
right.
already see it.
What does it mean? Right. And so then that was the beginning of what ended up becoming this book, because I realized that this term coming out was being harnessed and used in all sorts of different contexts to resist stigma, to organize for social change. And I'm coming back to fat phobia, because this term fat phobia also is clearly inspired by the term homophobia. And in both talking about coming out as fat and talking about homophobia, the fat acceptance movement has really taken inspiration from the gay rights movement and the LGBTQ plus movement.
Oh.
And has, you know, by using the similar terminology, is saying, you know, this is like, being fat is like being gay. We're discriminated against, but also, you know, you've been asking me questions that kind of assume like it's a choice. Would I want to be fat? Can you tell people not? But there's actually, and this is not my research, but there are geneticists who have shown that body size is just as determined by genetics as is height. And, you know, we know if you don't get proper nutrition, you won't grow to your full potential in terms of height. Likewise, with weight, what's available and how much food is available will affect. But there is a strong genetic component.
So fat phobia means to fear fat people?
It's a term that's used, as with homophobia, to convey fear, but also hatred as well of fat
But mostly
people.
To fear fat people,
The
right?
term phobia,
That's what phobia,
phobia
yeah.
but I think that actually in common parlance, when people use homophobia and they use fat phobia, they're talking as much about hatred and bigotry as they are about the
so
fear itself.
So are human beings taught fat phobia, or is that something that we naturally develop? Is to not like fat people, you know, not like a person that's
yeah,
fat.
So
I would never date a fat woman, right? So does
you would
mean,
never date a fat woman, is
right.
what you said.
Mm-hmm. Does that mean that I'm fat phobia, or just I'm not attracted to that?
So it can be a mix of both. I think that in getting back to your issue of,
are we taught that
of what we're taught, you know, this is getting back to your very first question in terms of what sociology. So one of the things that sociologists look for when we're trying to figure out, is this socially produced or does it have other origins in genes or in evolution, is we look for variation. And you can definitely, I mean, actually in most places over history and still today in the world, it's not the just talking, you know, taking viewing from maybe a heteronormative frame for a second, the women who are considered desirable are not the skinny ones. They're the heavy ones.
In what world is that?
Most places.
Like
most
where?
Places over society. Well, in
like over across the sea?
Today, many places across the, a lot of places where food is not so abundant as it is in today in the U.S. But if you were to do a survey of, you know, societies over time across the world, in most places, the fact that, you know, the if you, what's really strange are the women who were considered desirable. If you open up a fashion magazine, super skinny,
right.
incredibly tall, almost impossible. In terms, I mean, you know, so that really does require an explanation.
So what you guys are trying to do, if I'm hearing this correctly, you're trying to convince society to accept fat as a norm, not look at them and think, wow, that's a fat one, right? You're trying to cause society to see an abnorm as a norm?
So my project in the book, What's Wrong with Fat, the 2013 book, was to look at what are the different ways that it's understood. And one of the, we talked about the public health crisis frame, the medical frame, the organization I went to, NAFA, the National Association to Advance Fat Acceptance, is advancing two alternative frames, I would argue. One is one I call a beauty frame, or fat is beautiful, reclaiming that. So reclaiming like the Rubens paintings and recognizing that, you know, Rubens painted beautiful women. They were all heavy. And one of them is on the cover of that 2013 book.
Right.
There are also public health or clinicians who have been arguing for an approach of health at every size. And so this would be more about, let's not focus on the weight, so they care a lot about
but
health.
You can't help but see what you see.
You know.
And then fat people are sick, they're a burden to the family, they're high medical costs. When I was, I remember a time in America, especially in the black community, black women were getting really fat at some point. Mm-hmm. And they said it's not healthy because heart attacks and things like that, and it came from eating the wrong type of meats and things like that. So they told the black people, you better cut back. And so blacks start to cut back, and they were living longer, getting better. And then after the civil rights movement, they said, all right, black people, eat what you want, get as fat as you want, we'll make it beautiful. And now they're dying out. Which is best, to guide them in the right way, or let's let them be fat? Like that woman that I was telling you about, the rapper woman.
Lizzo.
Yeah, she's gross. She was at a basketball game showing her nasty fat butt, and she's old. It's like they're losing control.
So I don't know if we're looking at the same Lizzo, because, I mean, the one I've seen is pretty gorgeous and pretty young. But I think...
But isn't it best to be honest with them rather than
I think we should be honest about what we know and what we don't know. And we don't know how to make fat people thin. And so telling them they should become thin...
I used to be fat.
...is not...
I got so fat, I didn't reckon. I was interviewed in a hometown newspaper, and it says, hometown boy make it big, right? I went home, and they were making a big deal of it, and they took a picture of me, and the next morning I looked in the paper, and I saw that picture. I did not recognize me, myself, and I'm like, yeah, I made it big, all right, but I made a decision in that very moment, I'm going to get rid of the fat, and I got rid of it. Why don't we demand that? That's how all people do.
Things have worked out in a positive way for you, and that's wonderful. But most of the time, if we tell people that they need to lose weight, what's going to happen is they will lose weight temporarily and gain it back, and that's not helpful. But I want to go back to what you were saying earlier, because we do know of some things that will improve your health, and they often get lumped with weight, but they don't have to be. And so that is getting back to the health at every size. That's exactly what health at every size movement tries to do. So we know that certain you know, certain foods are better. It's good for most people. There's variations on what you should be eating based on your own susceptibilities, et cetera. But for most people, eating more fruits and vegetables, eating less processed food is going to be better for them. So we can encourage drinking a lot of water, not drinking sodas. You can certainly make that easier and encourage people to do it in a way that is empowering and not judgmental. Exercise is incredibly health promoting for everybody. And
do you exercise?
I exercise a lot.
And do you are you careful with what you eat?
I do.
Right
I
on.
Am. Yeah.
And so look how you look. But suppose you were sitting there peeking out on everything, you'll take up that whole seat.
Well, what I was going to say earlier is that there are a lot of people who can eat well, exercise, do everything right, and they're still going to be fat. Now, all of their panels are going to be great. You know, the exercise and the eating well is going to have excellent impact on their blood pressure, on their cholesterol levels, on every. They're going to be in great health. And we should encourage them to continue and not, you know, what does happen today is someone is out on a, you know, biking, a very heavy woman biking, you know, out in public or at the gym doing everything right, and someone says, fat ass, you know, that. And then that person's like, I don't want to go out anymore. I don't want to exercise, right? So that kind of negative assessment of people is just not helpful. It's not helpful.
I saw a fat, I was at the gym the other day, and I was on the steps, and I saw a fat Mexican on the treadmill thing, and he was like really fat. He had fat hanging all down everywhere. And I was thinking, I wonder how you get that fat. And I wanted to ask him, is that judgmental?
Well, it's making a judgment.
But not judgmental, right?
It's probably, people would say it's judgmental, but you know,
but I didn't hate him for it. I didn't know
that.
Like,
and these are things we do. We're making judgments all. We're making judgments all the time.
Everybody does.
We do it. We do it. And I'm not one to kind of throw stones from glass houses.
Right
I think
on.
What I try to do in my work, and you know, writing this work and doing the work that I do is also educates me.
Absolutely.
You know, I learn about a population that isn't mine. I mean, that's one of the things that's interesting about this book, and it's a double-edged sword. But, you know, I write about lots of different groups and how they come out. And I'm not really a member of any of them, right?
On.
And so
You're not. You don't look like anything you write about.
You know.
Or anyone you write about. You look better than what you write about. And so I'm wondering, why don't you offer.
Not as well.
Why don't you offer what you're doing rather than try to encourage
them
to accept it?
I'm not a self-help writer, and I'm not writing. What I'm trying to do is I'm trying to understand, as a sociologist, how the world works and how we reproduce systems of inequality, but also how people are able to gain control and resist and find freedom and liberation. And I think that this, you know, the coming out, the way people have done this, and I find the fat acceptance movement really inspirational.
How do, are we, give me a yes or no on this, are we taught to discriminate against fat people, or is this something natural?
Yes, we learn.
We learn. So I remember, and the reason I asked because when I read this, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I went to the first grade when I was 6 years old, right? In my day, you didn't go to school until you were six.
Mm-hmm.
And in that classroom was a fat girl, a black girl, that tried to like me. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to really hit on me. And I'm like, oh, get away, you fat pig. I don't like fat girls. Was I taught that? Because I had never heard that anything wrong with being fat or not being wrong, you know, wrong with it. But I knew I didn't like fat girls. It just didn't look right. Was I taught that, or did I naturally know that I didn't like fat?
I probably have to, you know, go back in time and talk to you and
no, I had never heard any discrimination.
But I think
and she was trying to like all, you know, she was going from guy to trying to get a boyfriend in the first grade.
Yeah, well, there might have been other things about her that you didn't like as well.
It was mostly the fat.
Yeah.
Because she was kind of cute. You know how fat girls are kind of cute, but.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, a lot of people do like heavier, you know, fat girls.
Right, there. I see it more
now. But I mean, if you look in terms of what images are we shown, even if you hadn't been to school, maybe you would have seen TV.
No, we didn't have TVs yet.
Magazines.
I grew up before they even invented TV.
Yeah, and what about the people in your
Let me
network.
Tell you why that was that way. When I was growing up, I grew up on a plantation in Alabama, and during that time, black people were not fat for the most part. They mm-hmm. had great bodies, the mm-hmm. men and the women. And so I wasn't accustomed to seeing yeah. fat people.
So it was different.
Yeah. They lived longer. They were healthier. They had, didn't have all that anger and stuff going on. Mm. And so they looked better. They
certainly,
better.
I hope we're not going to argue that the plantation is a healthy way to live, right?
Oh, yes, it is. You know uh-huh. why?
Why?
Because we plant all our food for the most part. Uh-huh. We ate right from the earth rather than going to the stores and uh-huh. all that. But the point I want to make is that there were no fat people around for the most part. They mm-hmm. were most healthy blacks. Mm-hmm. And they looked great, the girls. So all the girls that I was attracted to were, you know, they had great bodies. They weren't all fat. But my point is, was I fat phobia because I wasn't attracted to that?
I mean, I think there's maybe something, but again, this is kind of wandering a little bit outside of my area of expertise, but I think that there may be something where we mistrust or we don't like difference. And so if someone, you know, this was a body type that you weren't used to seeing, then we can't argue that it's universal or natural, because there's plenty of places around the world historically and still today where girls, you know, are fattened up for marriage. They're not considered marriageable right. unless they gain weight. And so, you know, that wouldn't happen. It wouldn't make sense if preference for thin bodies were universal.
I want one last question about the fat phobia.
Sure.
Stuff, because you're so interesting that I have so much I want to talk to you about. You have more than, how many degrees do you have?
I have 2 PhDs, one from Princeton and one from a university in Paris called L'École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales.
Oh, excuse
me. Now you
repeat
that now. each of those PhDs was preceded by a master's, so two
wow.
masters, and then a Bachelor of Arts.
So you know what you're talking about. You've done some real studying.
I know a few things. Yeah. There's a lot that I don't know.
Yeah. I wanted to know from you, why aren't homosexuals straight phobia? I noticed that homosexuals hate straight people. They want to impose their lifestyle on them. When the straight people or the Christians say, no, I don't want to be involved. Do what you want, but I'm not a part of that. I noticed that the homosexuals are straight phobia. They tend to hate straight people, so they want to corrupt them all. Why is that?
No. So
you got to work on that?
I don't know that that's true.
Do you study that?
I have not studied that.
You need to study that because they're trying to impose
it. I have not observed that. I have many friends, in fact, who are gay, lesbian, and transgender, and none of them have tried to. I'd say the thin people are much more proselytizing. Those people, you know, they go out and they tell you, you should lose weight.
But when these people
be thin like me. But no one has ever tried to recruit me into.
When those people are trying to pass laws to make straight people accept an abnorm as a norm, when they are trying to force it on little kids now, like drag queen story time at the library, when they are trying to just make you accept it, isn't that straight phobia?
I don't think it's straight phobia.
Why not?
I don't think they're trying to. I give a different perception of what they're trying to do.
But what are they trying to do if they're not trying to force you to accept? It's like they're afraid of straight people.
People who are trying to pass laws that say black people should have equal rights.
But being black and being a homosexual, homosexuality is about, it's not about civil rights, it's not about family, it's not about love, it's about sex.
And so
are trying to make the straight people accept that. My question to you.
I think that is the question about what. This is what I do try to address in my book. So the book. That book, but also the earlier one. I mean, in general, my work, I'm really interested in what is this a question of? What is the right question to ask here? How do we understand this issue? And so you're saying that it's about sex, but the whole LGBTQ rights movement is saying it is about civil rights. It is
about. But it's not, though. They lie. They lie. They lie.
So these are,
it's all about sex. Believe me, if they didn't have sex together, there would be no homosexuality, right?
Well, so, would there be heterosexuality?
But my question
is
that
sex?
Straight phobia, when they try to impose that stuff on little children, whether the parents want it or not, they still try to impose it anyway. And they hate straight people when straight people don't accept it. Straight phobia from the homosexual?
I think it's different when you are asking to be treated with equal rights and human dignity than when you're saying, I think that is a different argument than saying that other people should not be treated as equal.
But I'm asking you, though, when nowadays they're trying to impose it on us, because at first, if you remember, they said, oh, we want to come out the closet. We just want to come out of the closet. Let us out. And for a long time, the normal people said, no, keep that stuff in the closet, right?
And right, so, the McCarthy era in the 1950s, gay
people weren't allowed to have jobs. So finally they said, okay, y'all can come on out of the closet. So they let them out of the closet, and now they're at a point where they're trying to force it on the people, especially the straight people. And if the straight people say no to it, then they pass laws that say, no, you're going to accept it. Mm. Is that straight phobia?
It sounds like you're really worried about what's happening.
No,
right,
I'm asking
now.
You, is that straight? You're the expert. I'm asking, is that straight phobia?
I've never heard of the term straight phobia, but I'm interested.
Will you study that for me?
No.
Why not?
I have so much on my plate. I've got a whole...
Put this one last piece on your plate.
No. But I'm really interested in what it is that you are afraid of. Like, what is going to happen? What are they going to force you to do?
Well,
that you don't
I'm not
do?
Afraid of anything. My concern is because the straight phobia thing is happening now, that they're just going to corrupt everybody, the little kids and everyone
else. And
what'll
happen to the little kids?
Everybody will be homosexuals and lesbians.
Do you think that is likely?
No, but I want you to study straight phobia and let me know what that is, all right?
Do you think, though, that it's likely that everyone's going to become gay if we reduce the stigma against gay people?
Yep. Oh, yes.
Everyone.
Because that's what happened when
every
we let them out of the closet.
Every straight person has a gay person inside trying to get out.
We have some radical homosexuals that are trying to force that upon it.
But
they're numb.
If it were true, which I don't believe it was true, but even if we imagine that there were a band of people
That you're not answering my question about straight phobia.
I can't answer your question because it's framed in a way that I can't.
Why not?
Because it doesn't. You
have all these degrees and you can't answer. You did all the studies but straight phobia, right?
I can't answer a question about something that I haven't seen.
Will you
it's
study
like
it?
If you ask me about the
have
green
you seen
Martians.
Drag queen reading time at the library? You ever seen that?
I have.
Is that straight phobia or not?
No, I don't think it is.
Well, why are they trying to impose that on? They have a fat man in a dress, nasty dress, mm-hmm. trying to impose that on little children. Is that straight phobia or
I
not?
The way I understand that is it's an effort to share different kinds of diversity with children. Now, the parents
but nobody
can decide,
want that stuff.
Well, if they don't want it, then they won't go, and there'll be no one sitting at the drag queen story time.
That makes sense. I want to ask you about sexual harassment. You write a lot about that.
I wrote a whole book on that.
Yeah. Sexual harassment.
That was my first book.
Yeah. I studied you.
So... You studied me.
I read your books.
You read up on me. I love it. Yeah.
How do you find sexual harassment? How do you define that?
So I don't tend to define things in my work. I like to ask, how have other people defined things? How do other people understand it? And then why? So my first book was called What is Sexual Harassment?
Right.
The second book is What's Wrong with Fat? And then I have a colleague who told me you can't have any more questions in your titles.
That's right.
So that's it.
Well, but at least you made people think, what is that really?
What is it? Yes, and so this was actually the same. This study began as my doctoral dissertation.
Right.
And so I compared the United States and France. And I noticed that they had very different ways of defining sexual harassment in their laws, and that those laws then had implications for how everyday people on the street and in companies, et cetera, understood what sexual harassment was. And so that was my contribution. It wasn't for me. There are legal definitions, and those legal definitions are different in across different countries. There's corporate definitions and different corporations that are going to differ. So there's multiple ways that we can define
what
this
is,
issue.
Is there one primary definition for sexual harassment? Well, one that, I know they have all the little definitions, but is there one primary definition?
So the United States, only the United States, not other countries, has a definition that was originally developed in the EEOC guidelines, the Equal Opportunity, EEOC, Equal Employment Opportunity Commission guidelines. That's the same administration that, it was the administration that enforces Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which makes it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, and other things as well as sex.
Right.
And so the EEOC guidelines have defined two different kinds of sexual harassment. First of all, in the United States, unlike, for instance, in France, sexual harassment is a subset of sex discrimination. And so it's a form of discrimination, and it may happen because of, there's two kinds. There's quid pro quo, in which you say to an employee.
Do me a kind of favor, because I'm black and I'm slow and I'm trying to figure it all out as you're speaking. Give me a normal definition for sexual harassment. What is it?
Yeah, well, so there's no normal definition for sexual harassment, but an American legal definition from the EEOC guidelines would be it's a form of sex discrimination in which you make either quid pro quo, you make submitting to sexual activity a condition of employment, or behavior in the workplace is so pervasive that it in and of itself becomes so severe or pervasive that it becomes a condition of employment.
Oh,
it
okay.
negatively affects your ability to do the job, and it is then therefore considered a form of discrimination on the basis of sex.
So to break that down is a lot of these companies have hired women to run them, right? And a lot of these women are harassing men. They discriminate against the men. They put the woman up first. Or they promote the woman over the man, and they do that. So is that sexual harassment?
So the overwhelming majority of people who harass others at work are men.
No, that's not true.
It's absolutely true.
Now, I got proof that's not true.
Yes, what's
but
your
let
proof?
Me hear yours first. Go ahead. Yeah. You're my guest.
Well, so the studies that I have read, many studies, will show that the overwhelming majority of harassers are men. The overwhelming number of victims are women. Most of the men who are harassed by other men, although it does also sometimes happen that a woman will harass a man. And under the law, that is completely possible. The law is gender neutral. It does not say that only women can be victims and only men can be perpetrators. So in either case, in terms of if you're in the case, under the context of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you need to show that it was discriminatory, you were treated this way because of your sex, either man or woman, and you need to show that it negatively affected your employment in a way that was severe and pervasive.
Do you study men who have been sexually harassed by women?
I haven't spoken to victims, men or women.
And why not?
That wasn't within the study. Whenever you do a research study, you have to make hard choices. And, you know, I say to my graduate students, the best dissertation is a done dissertation. You got to get it done.
Yeah.
And so I was already doing a lot. I looked at all of the legal history and court case law in the U.S. I looked at legal history in France. I did interviews with experts.
I guarantee you, if someone took the time and did a study on sexual harassment from women to men, mostly women would be in jail today. They would be lined up with Harvey Weinstein having lunch in jail, right? And I am encouraging men now because I've heard so many stories over the last 30 years or so. I'm encouraging them to start reporting to women, having them arrested, documenting everything that happened so that the men can start putting these women in jail and not letting them get away with it. Is that a good idea? Because more men are being harassed
now. Harvey Weinstein was
I'm asking just one particular question. Is that a good suggestion?
Well, there is a big problem with it because we've been talking about sexual harassment under Civil Rights Act.
My suggestion to the men.
It's civil. It's a civil law, so you don't go to jail.
But my suggestion to men is to start to report the women for sexual harassment.
Well, I think anyone who's been victimized, man or woman, should report it. And for men who have been, and there are men who have been victimized, and transgender people as well are very at high rates victimized. But for men who have been victimized, whether by a man, which is much more likely, or women.
No, not today. It's mostly women. It's really mostly women.
Well, I would love, maybe after we're done talking, you'll send me those studies because I have been studying this topic for 30
years. You have all the degrees.
Yes, and with my degrees and the studies, I have never seen that statistic.
Because they lied to you then. But you never done a study, that's why.
But other people have done said, let me just finish what I'm saying, that I want to partially agree with you to say something, which is that it is, I think there are studies that suggest that when men have been victimized, especially sexually, it is more difficult for them to come forward and to report it because of the gender stereotypes that men are supposed to be strong, they're not supposed to be victimized, that, you know, all of this. And so there's a kind of a double stigma. It's already difficult
to stigmatize.
But
that's not a stigma. A man is not supposed to be a beta male. You got to get that right.
No, when a man is...
But a man shouldn't be a beta male, right?
I'm saying that society...
Should a man be a beta male?
I don't deal in shoulds.
No. Would you marry a beta male?
That's a personal question. I'm already married, so I can't. My father used
it's
to say.
Is he a beta?
My father said about my husband that he's a what did he say? He's a closet alpha. That he's an alpha pretending not to be, something like that. I have to remember. I have to ask my mom.
Oh, so he was really an alpha male, but he pretended to be a beta male with you?
That he didn't come off as. He comes back as more laid back than
more like
maybe
a beta
he really
male.
Is.
Yeah. Amazing.
But, yeah.
The Me Too movement, you heard
sure.
of that, right? Wouldn't you agree with me that they've gone too far with that? It's a joke now?
No, I would not agree.
Why not?
We have so far to go. So the truth is there... It's a real problem, and a tiny, tiny proportion of victims ever come forward. And this, you know, I was not expecting this Harvey Weinstein. I was not expecting him to be convicted. This was a
Me
big...
Me either, because this it was on false allegations, right?
And that wasn't why. It's because so many women who have come forward with... It's just so hard for women to win, even when they have... When they're telling the truth again and again, which is... The overwhelming majority of the time, it's very rare that women.
You know why that is,
up.
Right?
Why? What is?
Why? Sometimes women don't win when they make these accusations. You know why they don't win sometimes, right?
What you're gonna say, sure, is not what I'm gonna say.
What are you saying?
But
why
this is
it?
Your show.
No,
so
but
you
might guess. You're the expert. Why is it sometimes that women don't win those cases?
Well, it's very hard to win a case in criminal court of sexual assault.
Right.
The whole criminal system is based to, and understandably so, rightfully so, we want to avoid people being wrongfully convicted. And so it's innocent beyond, you know, you have to prove that someone is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt.
Does that concern you that these women can ruin the reputation of men by false accusations? That could happen?
Does that concern you? Of course, I wouldn't want that to happen to someone who was falsely accused. But it's what is much, much more common is so many more women who are victimized who never come forward.
That's not true.
No, it is true.
No.
Believe me, I'm the expert. That's why you brought me out
you're the
here.
Expert.
I'm telling
you're
you,
the
it's
expert.
True. You
you're,
might not like to think, listen, believe it, but it's
you're
true.
You're the expert, but I have the common sense. So I know that's not true, right?
Well,
but let me tell you this. Let me tell you this.
Common sense is sometimes a dangerous thing.
Common sense is the only way to go.
It leads you to ignore facts and to reinforce your preconceived assumptions.
I know why.
So be cautious about that.
No, common sense is the problem is people don't use common sense anymore. They use the intellect, and the intellect lacks common sense. And that's why the world going to hell in a handbasket.
So why the hell am I sitting here?
Do you use common sense? You don't use common sense?
I do use common sense, but I'm saying preconceived
notions.
I thought
you use common sense.
Of course I use common sense. Oh. But I also like to see the facts and the studies, and I know that we can often assume things are right based on what everybody else, the kind of preconceived notions, and those are often wrong.
Let me ask you this because of time. Some of the time, the women, most of the time, even though the courts are on the women's side, not the ladies' side, they can accuse you and say whatever they want and get away with it. But the reason that I'm glad that a lot of these cases the women lose is because women are, it's easy for women to lie, and they don't mind destroying you. If they get angry at you, because a lot of women, you hit on them, and they go, yeah, I want to do it, let's do it, let's do it. And then as soon as you do it, they get mad because they become addicted to you, they want to control you, and then they'll falsely accuse you. And the courts are set up to believe the woman over the man, so that's why this needs to end, because a lot of these women don't mind destroying men. They'll destroy the men's children in the womb and outside the womb. We need to stop this movement before it goes too far. Don't you agree?
It sounds like you've had some really painful experiences.
Oh, no, I've never had that.
I
just know other men who've gone through that. But do you agree it's time to end this type of, this crazy so-called women? And look at the women in the movement. Nobody want them anyway. I think they're mad because no one want them. They're like lesbians, and they're fat, they're ugly, they're short hair. Nobody want them. I think they're mad about that. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I wouldn't. Sorry. I think we're talking past each other.
What do you mean?
I am speechless. What can I say?
Why are you speechless?
Because I'm at a loss for words. No, I think the sexual assault and discrimination is a really big problem. And I think that it's great that we're starting to address the issue, but there's a lot more to go. I do not think that the criminal justice system can solve this issue. I think we need to look into companies, and I mean, you were saying that women are running the companies. There's actually very few women in positions of power. It's overwhelming, and it's not just women and men. Again, it's overwhelmingly white men.
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with it is that there hasn't been accountability, and when you have...
What do you mean by that?
The power inequalities and the fact that people are able to mistreat people who have lower status in the workforce is enabling some of the, not just sexual harassment, but also the gender discrimination and the racism.
So you're saying
and
that,
these things are
you're
often
saying
combined.
That white men in position of power are mistreating employees?
I'm saying that certainly it happens, and that there needs to be, you know, we know that there's less sexual harassment when hierarchies are more flat, for instance, and that the greater inequalities of power, and when
but
people
have
no one they can complain.
There's no proof that white men...
Oh, there's been a lot of
it's just made up stuff. It's not true.
Okay, well...
But I got to ask, is there such a thing as a strong woman? Are women strong?
I think women are very strong.
Then why do they need laws to force people to do what they cannot do?
Why do men need laws to protect their rights?
No. I'm asking, if these women are strong, why do they need laws to force men to do what they want?
I think men and women alike need laws. We are a nation of laws, and that is supposed to protect.
But the laws that we have protect men
and
women.
The laws.
Why do they need special laws?
Most of the time, they don't protect. And most of the time, you're not going to be able to resolve your issue in court. There are a tiny percentage of these cases ever make it to court. So it's not enough.
It's not like amazing to hear you say that. That's not true. It's so not. Have you talked to Gloria Allred lately?
All the time.
How would you
Every
like,
night before I go to sleep.
How would you like to marry that one, huh? Are you a Great White Hope supporter?
Hmm?
Do you support the president, President Trump?
I do not.
You do not support the president?
But I don't know that I want to say this online because maybe I'll receive hate mail.
Oh, no, don't worry about that. I get it all the time. You don't support President Trump?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that, honestly. I feel like it's an unsafe environment to talk about politics.
I thought women were strong.
Uh-huh.
I'm not afraid to talk about it. I don't talk about anything.
Yeah.
So I thought women were strong.
Let's talk about my book.
Oh, yeah. I got to ask you about your book.
Let's show them my book.
I got to have you back. Will you come back?
Sure. It's been such a delight.
I do want to talk about your book. Come out, come out, come out, come out.
Whoever you are.
And because of the time now, what is the book about? I know what it's about. You want everybody and their mama to come out the closet, right? Tell the folks what it's about.
Yeah, so it's about how, it begins with a history of coming out within LGBTQ community, how it was originally not about coming out of the closet, but coming out into gay society. And in the 50s, which was a very repressive time when you couldn't have public employment, where there were lots of jobs, there was a huge oppression against people who were known to be gay, lesbian, it came to have a more of a kind of code. So you coming out meant you would come out to other people, like-minded people.
Yeah.
So you use code phrases like a friend. This is a friend of Dorothy's or family to let the people in the know, but not anyone else because it was too dangerous.
The world. Yeah.
And then it wasn't until the 60s that it became part of a political strategy of challenging people. So when people have these, you know, some of these views that you've been sharing about how, you know, gay people are bad or, you know, shouldn't have rights, etc., then when your friend or your neighbor comes out and says to you, you know, I'm gay, you're like, oh, wait, but I like you.
That's not what I say.
So maybe
I'll tell them, go back in.
But other people,
sit down and shut up.
Luckily, other people have been like, that makes me rethink my biases. So it tells the history of coming out within the LGBTQ community, and then it starts to talk about some of the other groups that have used it. So what does it mean to come out as fat when your body size is visible? Why are they using this term? How the undocumented immigrant youth movement has talked about coming out as undocumented and unafraid to mobilize youth that are really afraid of being deported.
That's the one that I did agree with you about.
Okay, great.
I hope all the illegals come out of the hiding, and once they're out, we can arrest them and ship them back home.
All right. So that isn't the strategy that they're working on now. It's working about on coming out and challenging these things and replacing terms like illegals with things like with different term like undocumented. And then maybe you'd like this though. There's the chapter on coming out as polygamous among Mormon fundamentalists. Maybe a group would be more simpatico for you.
One woman is enough, believe me.
So that's an interesting one because this is a conservative, homophobic group, and yet they're talking about coming out using a language that's very associated with gay rights. And then the last chapters we've just been discussing is on the Me Too movement and the politics of coming out, but also of outing, which we've touched on in there. So that's what the book's about.
I recommend people read your book. I really do. Because I get the impression that you want everything that's wrong to come out. Out of the closet, right?
That would be maybe your perspective. What I think is we all, you know, none of us are. Irving Goffman coined the term stigma to talk about an unwanted difference. And he used the term normal, which you've also used, to talk about people who are without stigma. And Goffman said none of us are normal. We all have different kinds of stigmas that we have to, you know, that we tend to downplay or to hide. And so coming out is also about revealing to ourselves and others the person who we are. And this can be sometimes about coming into our more authentic self and sometimes about challenging negative stereotypes so that we can bring about a more just and fair and equal world where everybody can be free.
Do you suggest that straight white men come out and start being afraid of being called white supremacists and all that, but come out and start speaking up and defending themselves?
There's certainly...
Do you suggest that?
I don't suggest that because I see white supremacy... So this is what we were talking about earlier. White supremacy is a philosophy of hatred and of
but
keeping
it's a made
other
up
people
thing.
Down.
It's not real. It's a lie. And
how
so? It's like the white phobia people. You know how the people, they hate the white people, and especially white straight men. Those are white phobia people. Mm-hmm. They're pretending that there's white supremacists, and they have intimidated white people to hide in a closet. should they come out.
Do you really believe that as a black 100%.
Man? 100%.
Really? How do you square that?
I can see that it's all made up lie to control a certain segment of the population to get what, to gain something from them, to put them in fear. Should those white straight people come out and not be afraid of white phobia anymore?
Well, they certainly have come out, whether they should or they should not. I talk in the conclusion about white supremacists coming out of the woodwork, which I really...
And that's a good thing,
No, I'm not celebrating it. I think it's an interesting analogy, though, coming out of the woodwork. It's so interesting how this term coming out has moved from coming out into society, which was borrowing from debutante balls, high society, coming out of closets, small kind of domestic space. The undocumented youth movement talks about coming out of shadows, which is a different way to pair the metaphor. And this was actually a journalist talking about white supremacists coming out of the woodwork. And I think it's a really interesting analogy in that, you know, what comes out of woodwork? Vermin comes
like
out of woodwork.
Like so the illegal alien and the homosexuals and the lesbians and the LBG, they're like vermins coming out.
Well,
huh?
So I was suggesting, you know, it was used in terms of talking about white supremacists.
Oh.
And I think that was the, I don't think any human being is vermin, but I think that was the metaphor.
But you just call the white people vermin.
No, I said that who comes out of woodwork, where is the metaphor coming? So I thought that was an interesting use of a metaphor from a journalist.
Oh, I see. It's time for me to heat this interview up, folks.
Oh,
I have
no.
to put my guest on the hot seat.
I thought we'd already done that. Thought you were going to let me off the hook here.
I need you to answer these questions as quickly as possible.
Oh, no. Okay, I'm scared now.
The hot seat.
Would you bring a child to a drag queen story hour?
Absolutely, with pleasure.
Should conservative be censored on social media?
I don't believe in censorship.
I'm sorry?
I believe in censorship.
Should women watch porn?
If they want to.
Does Trump deserve credit for a good economy?
Mostly not, maybe a little bit.
Do black people deserve reparations?
I think so.
Is Facebook evil?
I think it's more complicated than that.
Should we limit travel to America from hostile nations?
We have all kinds of limitations, but I don't think we should ban travel from specific nations.
Do you support the Green New Deal?
Yes.
Are you...
This is a liberal test that you're giving me.
Are you okay with transgenders dominating women's sports?
Transgender people, not transgenders, I think is the preferred term.
But are you okay with transgenders dominating women's sports?
Am I okay with transgender people dominating? I think that's a complicated question. I can't answer that yes or no.
Do you love white people?
I love some white people and not others.
Do you love black people?
I love some black people and not others.
Do you love Jews?
I love many Jews and not others.
Can having an abortion cause mental health issues for women?
I don't think there's been shown a correlation for that. Anything can, but I don't think that it's been shown that it does.
Did you have fun?
It was a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Whatever you're promoting, your books, let us have it now.
The book is available on Amazon.
Yeah.
Please buy it.
Yeah.
And talk about it. And yeah, that's it.
Abigail, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much.
And you will come back for a part two.
Okay.
Thank you all for tuning in. I absolutely appreciate it. Don't forget to like, follow, share, all the merch and all the good things. Let me hear from you. Thank you so much.
Next time on The Fallen State.
Injuries have been a big part of my career. I've had ACL replace my left knee, ACL replace my right knee, 50% of my meniscus taken on my right knee. I've had L4-5 S1 fused in my lower back. I've had T3, T2, T2, T1, T1, C7 disc replacement.
Hey.
I've had C7, C6 fused. I've had C6, C5 disc replacement and C5, C4 fused and a reattached retina in my left eye. I think it just makes me more of a mentally strong person because I've gone through so much, but I'm able to bounce back. I had a dream. I had a dream of being a Hulk Hogan. And my mom would sit there with a paper towel of little hole and be like, Tito Ortiz.
All I want to say, to say, to say.
Thanks for watching The Fallen State. We need your continued support. Donate to my nonprofit here. Subscribe and like the videos here. And tell everybody and their mama about the show. Don't know what you're saying.